you know, something unlucky happens or lucky happens, and we even you have a terminology for it, luck, when all it is well, that, a specific that's a really pattern to the random.
You know, when we feel like there's a chain of bad things happening, we say we have bad luck, or we say that we're cursed. And then obviously, conversely, when it's a bunch of good things, we say we have good luck. But the interesting thing about that is, you know, you can have one person in a situation where they feel like they're very lucky, and another person can be in basically an identical situation. You know, so we could say at work, you have somebody who's very happy in their environment and with what's going on. And then you have a person right next to them who's very unhappy about it. And the only difference between their situation is their outlook on it. So they are seeing a different pattern in the same exact information.
And you and I have talked a lot about the fact that we're just basically primitive pattern recognition machines. And based on our experiences, based on our hopes, based on our desired outcomes, the exact same situation could feel lucky or unlucky just based on the individual that's experiencing it.
Right. You know, and that makes me think of, you know, when somebody says, like, you know, one too many brush strokes on the Mona Lisa, it's like you have, you know, there's one way of looking at it of saying, oh, here's a beautiful situation with only one imperfection. And then you would have another person look at that same situation and think that that one imperfection ruins the entire thing. And they're both looking at the exact same thing, but because they sort of have their radar tuned a little differently, they come away with a completely different feeling about a single imperfection. You know, so someone might curse that single imperfection, whereas another person would say, oh my God, how you have this thing that is as close to perfect as possible. There's only one imperfection. That's great.
I'm of a similar mindset with, let's say, I don't appreciate art necessarily, but let's look at woodworking, for instance. I would much rather see something live edge, like on a table, than I would with a sharp, clean edge, like it came from a mass-produced deal. And, you know, the exact same coffee table, to me, with the live edge, looks amazing. It brings out a natural character. To me, it's not a flaw, but someone different that likes stuff from, let's say, like the sharper image, got nothing against the store, but wants nice, clean, modern lines, would absolutely reject that out of hand as being furniture they would want to have.
That's a really good point. You see it as character or a characteristic, or as they would see it as an imperfection.
So I would say that probably throughout our lives, everything that we experience, it's all truly random. As much random as random can be when you've got cause and effect that's going on, but it's very easy to attribute some kind of agency to that randomness. You called it luck just a few minutes ago, and unluck is another good way of looking at it. And based on solely just what our outcomes are desired, like we mentioned, it seems to be that it's all too easy to look at all this stuff that's happening around us, as you've mentioned many times before, just completely complex interactions that there's no way our minds can wrap themselves around and try to find some kind of reason for everything that happens.
Well, yeah, it's too big. So we have to do some, we have to do some cognitive shortcuts, or else we would go insane. Right. So something that, we've brought up that we've talked about to each other is, you know, we view a coin flip as a random event. It, you know, it can either be heads or tails. So we call it that because something so simple as a coin flip actually has so many variables going into it. So, you know, I put a coin on my finger, I flip my thumb up, how hard did my thumb push on it? Is there any wind? There's all of these things. But because it's just too much, it's just too much going on. We somewhat correctly just say it's random enough. But you know, we might be mad at the coin. So say we, say you have a favorite football team and, you know, they might be a team that, wants to receive at the beginning of the game. Well, if all season, you know, they had to, they lost the coin flip every time, we would just be nuts with how unfair the situation is and how there's something going on. We would be, you know, like you brought up earlier, we would say like, this is just horrible luck. We would attribute more impact or more gravity to the fact that they lose every coin flip and sort of lose sight of the fact that nobody's really making that decision. We would assign agency where there is none, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. And like you said, with a coin, based on who's flipping it, how hard they flip it, is the center of mass, you know, completely perfect? Was there any win? Are there any outside things? I think you are correct in that we say random when the reality is it's just so complex. But something, when you brought up the football teams, it made me wonder, do you think superstitions have anything to do with this wanting to put some kind of agency on these actions that we just really can't understand?
You know, that's an excellent point, because, you know, my first level of kind of looking at this is, we kind of view ourselves as passive to this agency, but it's almost like superstitions are rituals we perform to try to appease this decision maker we can't see, if that makes sense. It's almost like a religious ceremony. It's like a religious ceremony to appease the gods, you know. So maybe you had some, you know, if we were to look at it as something that we would normally see that way, cargo cults, or, you know, some Hawaiian tribe that maybe throws somebody in the volcano or something, we would say, okay, they're doing that to appease the gods so that there won't be another eruption or there won't be a tropical storm. But we kind of still do these things, especially it seems in sports. You know, if there's a team's playing in the World Series in baseball, they won't shave, or they'll wear the same shirt or the same jock strap or whatever, because it's almost like they're doing that as tribute to this agency, this luck, this decision maker that's normally outside of their control. And I never noticed that parallel until you just said that.
And what's even funnier, you can almost dismiss the people that are the active participants in the event as having superstition. Now, granted, you and I both know that's not something that has anything other than maybe a psychological positive in your brain. You know, well, if I wear my lucky jock strap, then I'll pitch a no-hitter, and that convinces your brain to perform better, maybe, whatever. But what's even weirder are the fans that do the same thing. Like, well, every time I wear these holy socks, they've won. And like, you're trying to influence the outcomes of something. We're going to keep using the word random, but we've already established it's not really random, but trying to influence the agency that controls in your mind the outcome of events. And you're not even a party to it, other than you're watching it on TV. Maybe you've got a bet on it.
Yeah, it's a good point, because it almost makes you wonder if, you know, we get so invested in these things. So, you know, say we'll continue on with sports. When you're so invested in it, it's almost like you want to do whatever you can to participate in it. Because we have a lot of, it seems to me, I should say, I don't want to assert this, but it seems to me that when we have all of these things that are not in our control, we're very, very uncomfortable with it. And we'll go to some of these are trivial, right? It's trivial if I always wear my lucky socks when my team is playing. But that same thing ramped up, we'll go to some extreme and dangerous measures to try to cope with, control, or protect ourselves from these, again, you know, random in in quotations, events, because we hate the feeling of hopelessness.
Yeah, that's one thing you've seen repeated, or we've seen repeated many times, is when you take away a human's hope, then a lot of disastrous things happen. But what you were just speaking to just a minute ago, where with the lucky socks, and God, I didn't foresee us going down this path necessarily, but it's a good one. I wonder if we do this so that we feel like we're actually participating, like we're actually doing something, you know, to help the team out. We'll keep using the baseball or the football analogy, because we're so tribalistic. We've established that. It's not hard to see. And when your team wins, they say, "We won last night," or "We lost." These people aren't even sitting on the benches. They're not even filling Gatorade bottles. All you're doing is watching on TV, but you feel like your active participation in watching the team play makes you a part of that team. It makes you a part of, let's call it this agency.
Yeah. So there's actually kind of a weird little random fact here. This is how hard we tie into it. You know, if you have two men and they get in a fight, a physical fight, the winner of the fight, their testosterone level will actually go up, and the loser of the fight will have a drop in testosterone. But the interesting thing is, you know, sports fans, actually the same thing happens with them if their team wins or loses. So, you know, your body doesn't know the difference between, you know, this being a completely disconnected thing from you, because like you say, we have that tribalism so tied into us. So really it's to our body biologically, I would imagine this is almost a survival thing. So you know, at some part of you, you know, anything you can do is at least going to affect your survival. So, you know, we do have this really strong biological drive to try to affect these outcomes, because our body doesn't know the difference. Rationally, we might know the difference. But it's, you know, anybody who's been, you know, very hungry, very aroused, you know, has a strong craving, whatever it is, that can easily override your rational side. And I think that's why these things have so much weight with us, and why we'll throw out our reason, we'll throw out our rationality, and kind of perform these funny rituals, and or see more gravity to things that we don't really have control over than they really merit in our lives.
It's really terrifying when you think of the fact that what used to only happen in combat, let's think of it outside of humans. Let's look at two male deer that are fighting in the woods for the ability to procreate, to win favor, if you will, with the female. And it makes sense there. And in an evolutionary sense, it makes sense that a species that promotes the survival of the strongest typically does better in a natural atmosphere, you know, not necessarily in a civilized area like we live in now. But the fact that people identify so strongly with a team or with an individual, it probably like NASCAR, for instance, where it's just a driver, and that physiologically our brains tie that to our own survival and it really truly helps explain some of the worst behavior that we see, whether it be from alternative or opposing religions, maybe, where people are slaughtering each other, or were slaughtering each other, or saying the most hateful things, or doing hateful things to other people just because they're different. It's interesting, I guess, is a good way of putting it. I don't have another word for it.
Well, no, it is, but it's also, you know, when we think about it, that really does kind of boil down to this, you know, this whole we see an agency where there isn't one, because that's what we're fighting for. We're, you know, in the case of, you know, say, let's talk about, you know, the city of Jerusalem. You know, I shudder to think of how many people have died, you know, fighting for retaking, defending, and conquering the city of Jerusalem, you know, between the Muslims and the Christians, because of they're trying to appeal to that entity, that agency that they believe is there. But I mean, you know, the consequences of trying to appeal to or appease that agency is resulting in piles of bodies. I mean, that's a very big deal for something that, you know, we can easily talk about and say, you know, we're pattern seeking creatures, and we see agency, and we see, you know, maybe a being or a goal in this, you know, quote unquote randomness. But we are capable of ramping that up to an extremely dangerous level, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the thing that is kind of controlling these things I can't understand wants my people to occupy the city, and wants those people who don't like him out. So let's go do it. And the consequences are, you know, horrifying.
They're absolutely horrifying. And even in a secular aspect, we've been to the brink of human extinction during the nuclear arms race, just because of different ideologies.
Good Freudian slip there.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could see that. And, you know, again, this is just conjecture at this point, but one would have to assume that in the early days of trying to explain stuff, we were looking for, we being humans, primitive humans, we're looking for a reason why things happened, and we needed to have some kind of agency. We live in a world that is bound by cause and effect, at least as far as we know right now, at least the physical world. Maybe I'll leave it like that. And there had to be some unseen mover, some unseen causer, and we developed these religions out of that. The people that were right more often than they were wrong with their predictions and had the best stories were the ones that had their version or their agency populated, promulgated, I don't know what the right word is, to the masses.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this, there's, I don't know if I know you and I have discussed it. I don't know if it's been brought up on here, but there's a guy that wrote a book. His name is Daryl Ray. He wrote a book called The God Virus. And basically he talks about that. He talks about how, you know, if you have a pathogen, it has to have these certain characteristics, right? It has to be able to easily spread from one person to another. But just spreading to them is not enough. It has to be able to keep them as a host. And then that host has to be able to bring in other hosts and things like that. But there's all these different variables that makes a successful pathogen. But there's also the same thing with, and I won't just pick on religion here. I mean, this is ideology in general, right? If you have an ideology that spreads better, sticks better, and it's not always a bad thing. I mean, sometimes you can have an ideology that does bring prosperity or well-being to a populace, but that one's going to be the one that tends to, you know, spread either by force, unfortunately, or by, you know, voluntary joining of the community who buys into that ideology.
Right. Voluntary exposure versus forced exposure.
Right.
The corollary with a virus is very apt. The viruses that have the ability to replicate and spread before they kill the host obviously do a lot better, because with no method of transmission, it can't survive. Not for long, at least.
Exactly. And this is a little off of this train, but it kind of made me what we're talking about here, the seeing agency. This is something that I think somebody you and I both admire, and I don't know if this person did this intentionally, but Adam Smith, who wrote Wealth of Nations, coined an extremely famous term when talking about the free market. You know, and I'm a big believer in the free market. I know you and I share that. But to sort of, this is an example of where you have a lot of complexity, right? When you have, you know, where we are now, you have billions of people who could be trading with each other, goods, services, or ideas, or whatever. But there's so many variables. But if you're kind of a fan or a student, or, you know, well, I'll say an armchair student would probably best describe myself of how a free market economy works. There, it is a cause and effect deal, but the cause and effect is so complex that Adam Smith called it, and you can probably finish my sentence here,
the invisible hand.
The invisible hand, exactly right. He used, and I, again, I think he was a smart enough guy to understand, because he broke it down. He said, you know, here's why the, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, do, you know, specializing in their profession and trading has a better output than each of them doing it on their own. But to sort of convey this idea of how these vacuums will, in a free market, vacuums will be filled. You know, where there is a demand, someone will make a supply, and vice versa. But it, I think it was probably just easier for him to say, look, it's like an invisible hand, you know, that will kind of guide resources and people to where everybody is best suited.
Well, it would definitely speak to at least getting the idea across easier to people, because if we're already primed to see, like you said, agency in the randomness, implying that there literally is an invisible hand out there tweaking the dials and making things happen, right, would appeal to masses. But sitting here and trying to derive some equation to predict human behavior and how that human behavior is going to affect another one and another one, like all these, imagine this ocean that's completely flat and then it starts raining and you have all these ripples interacting with each other. That's kind of how the free market is in a very broad aspect, but there's no way to predict where the drops are going to fall and, you know, how far it's falling and how big the ripples are going to be and how they're going to affect the ripple after it or the ripples it encounters before it's, anyway.
Yeah.
No need to even get down there.
Yeah, that's one of those examples of the complexity is so high that one would maybe see agency. Every time we have a fad, so say a fidget spinner, right? I mean, you kind of have, you know, people about our age and older, you know, just rolling our eyes. The kids these days in this generation and they're crazy and what good is that going to do you? But the fact of the matter is, it was only a reflection of this weird little need that a lot of people had, something to mess with in their hand. But then you have, you know, kind of, you know, maybe older fogies like us kind of not understanding it and maybe being a little angry about it. I saw there seemed to be a lot of vitriol towards fidget spinners when that was a big thing. But, you know, I mean, I think people our generation and older were kind of a little vitriolic towards something like that. And I think we were saying, oh, this is a reflection of this generation. And giving it a little more gravity than it deserved, that's kind of another example. It's just, and I'm kind of talking about our age group and older, but the reality is this was the most benign, innocuous thing that could have possibly happened. You have a bunch of people who want this thing to play within their hand. But people saw it as this huge reflection of what it means that this generation would do that. And it was like, well, there's no harm in it at all. Like nobody's hurt. Nobody's rights are being violated. This is the most innocuous, benign fad that could possibly pass through society. But people saw it as having a lot more gravity and a lot more meaning than it really had.
Yeah, absolutely. Those kids should be taking prescription drugs as opposed to doing that to solve their anxiety issues.
Right, exactly. It's, yeah, you know, if play with that deal all day long. Yeah, I'd rather you be doing that than having somebody try to fix what isn't a problem.
Absolutely. And one of the other ones, and we'll kind of move on, and I think this bridges the gap pretty well. Constellations are another one of those very
excellent example.
Patterns. You know, we look up at the stars, and most of us know what the Big Dipper is, the Little Dipper is. We know where the North Star is. And a lot of this is based off of stories. Now, yes, absolutely make the argument that these stories help primitive navigators find their way home, find their way to their hunting, fishing, gathering lands, all that aside. But you're literally looking up at a black sky, at little pinholes of light traveling God knows how far, and finding patterns in the night sky, and then developing stories about these patterns that you see.
And I'll take it a step further from that. Not only did we do that and then see patterns in them, but then when it comes to horoscopes,
oh God,
we're saying that where those patterns happen to fall in the night sky is affecting our lives. Kind of go into that. I mean, that is an excellent example. You know, A, seeing the patterns, good example of, you know, where we're seeing agency and randomness. And then to, you know, put a Jenga block on top of that is, you know, there are an overwhelming amount of people who put some weight into astrology. You know, so for folks listening, astrology is the horoscope stuff, you know, the Virgo, Pisces, how your day is going to be. And astronomy is the actual science of studying, you know, the heavens. But there are a lot of people that ascribe to astrology, and that's one where we are definitely seeing some agency, seeing some patterns in things that have absolutely nothing to do with our day-to-day life.
Well, what is, and I hadn't even considered the astrology part of it, but you're making a very, very funny point in that, okay, we've got something that, like, if you went up to someone and said, okay, well, something happened randomly on this day, and the stars were in this random position, and these two random events let us predict with certainty what your future's going to be with no randomness. They would look at you and say, okay, how does random plus random equal certain? But that's exactly point, yes. what astrology does, is that you have to, on the one hand, say, okay, there's a certain agency to these events that are happening, even though they were completely random, they were completely outside of your control, but yet they somehow can predict your future for the rest of your life. Like what kind of day you're going to have, or even worse, what kind of personality, what other random people can you interact with? Well, you know, if they were born under a certain night sky, then you work well with them, but otherwise right. You don't. And we seek out the confirmation in that. Well, it says I read my horoscope and it said I was going to have a bad day, and I did. So I guess that means that it did, as opposed to looking at it going, maybe this influenced my pattern recognition and I only saw the bad things that were happening, or the good things, or however right. You want to look at it.
No, that's man, you really nailed it with random times random equals certain. Because yeah, like you said, I mean, the arbitrariness of the position of the stars on the day you were born, coupled with the fact that, you know, it the way that these clouds of gas collapsed into nuclear fusion furnaces billions of years ago. That's definitely it is definitely a stretch, but I've never quite heard it. I've never quite heard anybody make this connection of the random times random equals certain, but it's 100% true. It's a very good point. You know, it's funny. There's a couple of things I want to bring up on the astrology real quick. One is the only things that are reaching across that, you know, space and time, to a person being born, where the stars or the planets are, is gravity and electromagnetism. But the doctor in your delivery room is exerting more gravitational force on your newborn body than those stars or planets are, because he's so much closer to you. So that is a true fact. The other kind of funny thing is there was a guy, he's still alive. He's not as active anymore, but he's a skeptic. His name is James Randi. And he would have this challenge for, you know, it was $1 million challenge for anybody who could prove the supernatural. And he tested some astrologers, had them write up horoscopes for people, and then said it out like this, like told everyone to pick which one they thought fit them. And then it was revealed which ones were actually written for them. And obviously the matchup was random chance, which I think was none or maybe one. But that's kind of a good example of, you know, you had not only the astrologer, but you had the test subjects seeing meaning in things where there were no meaning. So you had the producer and the receiver of these predictions both putting all this importance. And when it was put to an actual test, obviously it failed.
Yeah, and this is my surprise face, if you could see it.
Yeah, oh yeah, I can hear it.
It's like, and we can kind of wrap up at least this section with this. It's like that test they did with the power of prayer. Well, prayer is trying to influence influence the agency that affects the random. And if I remember correctly, people that knew they were being prayed for actually did worse by only a very tiny, tiny margin than the people that did not. Like, the power of prayer had literally no effect.
That's correct, right? So they had, there were three groups. One was the control group, where nobody was praying for them. Another one was a group that did not know they were being prayed for. And then the third group knew they were being prayed for. There was no immeasurable difference between the group of people who were not being prayed for and the group of people who were being prayed for but didn't know it. But like you said, and it could be just statistical noise, but the group that actually did the worst was the group that was being prayed for and knew they were being prayed for. So, I mean, at this point, it, like you said, it was a very tiny difference, so it could just be statistical noise. But the other part is, did they feel some guilt or some obligation to get better and sort of stress themselves out a little more? Because, I mean, if you think about it, when you know that there's this group of people praying for you, what does it mean if you don't get better? What does it mean about your beliefs and their beliefs? You know, that's a stressor.
It absolutely is. And I think you and I've had that conversation before about being in some of the churches where testimony is happening and, you know, being a very young child, and you hear all these people that are talking about how God speaks to them and how they can feel his touch or his influence on their lives. If you don't feel that, what does that do to you psychologically? Right. Can you imagine? Well, God loves everyone else, but God doesn't love me.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine. As we've talked about previously in the podcast, I think it may have been the first episode. I grew up Catholic, which to be Catholic is to be very passive in church. I mean, you're doing a lot. You're sitting up, standing down, call response. But yeah, you don't really have to. You don't have to do anything other than be a robot. And I don't mean that as any disrespect to Catholics, but you guys know how Mass is. It's a very ritual thing that you just go through. So I never got put into that situation, but I can imagine, if I were in that situation, I would have felt like, okay, why is God talking to everybody but me? And, you know, I think I feel pretty crummy about it as a kid.
When I was still in the Mormon religion, we didn't have revivals per se. But there would, and I can't remember what it was called, but there would be certain times of the year where, I think it was called Fast and Testimony, where you would fast for 24 hours, and then within the congregation, they would hand out microphones, and you were expected to talk about your experiences with God. And the fasting was, of course, designed to make you feel closer to God, which is interesting when you consider the fact that when you're hungry, that's about the only thing that you can really think about. But, you know, I'm digressing there, but I remember being handed the microphone on several occasions, and you feel this immense pressure to say what everyone else wants you to say. Now, don't get me wrong, at the time, I thought that I was saying what I felt. But again, it's agency to the random. Was this God influencing an outcome on a specific test, or making my grandmother feel better, or, you know, we can ad nauseum go down the list, or was it just random? Well, I think these little ceremonies help reinforce that there is an agency behind what is happening to us, and you're hearing testimony from your peers, as opposed to the pastor, bishop, whatever you want to call
it. No, that's a good point. And like a lot of the things we do, when one of us talks, it sparks it, you know, a realization in the other one. So, you know, if you think about, I'll bring up praying and religion on this one, because I think it's the most apt example of it. But, you know, we might have a loved one, you know, in the hospital, and we don't know if they're going to make it. You know, so everybody gets together and they pray. And if that person survives, you know, so say they had a heart attack or a stroke and they went into emergency surgery and we don't know if they're going to make it. And if they make it, we say, oh, you know, praise God, you know, they made it. God is good. And if they die, it's, well, you know, it was their time and God called them home. So no matter what the outcome, no outcome can we not mold our, you know, sort of lens into accepting it as a reinforcer. So no matter whether they died, whether they got better, full recovery, partial recovery, no matter what the case is, we will say that it happened that way for a reason. Not just, you know, any possible outcome, we'll say, we will find in our minds and in our discussions, we'll find the reason for it. So it's kind of like an unfalsifiable hypothesis.
Absolutely. We say it was meant to be.
Right. Exactly. That's...
Well, on that note, go ahead.
No, please.
I can say on that note, I think it's meant to be the time to take a quick break and hear from our sponsor.
Sounds good.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. And we left off talking about basically finding agency in the random. I believe the phrase was, it was meant to be, is what we left it with. Now, Cole and I have been going back and forth about deeming something random, like random in quotations, but we both felt it would be a good idea to at least describe why we're saying that this isn't truly random, and I'll turn it over to you for that.
Sure. So, you know, we would tend to think of, you know, a coin flip, or, you know, pull a card out of the deck or something like that. We tend to think of those things as random events. Like, there's no, you know, for something to be random, you know, you have no input into it. You can't affect its outcome. So when we use random sort of in the everyday vernacular, I thought it'd be kind of an important distinction to make that almost no events that we really observe are truly, truly random events. There's always, all of these causes that sort of, affect the outcome or lead up to an event. So they're not truly random, but when something has so many inputs going into it, that it's practically impossible to predict its outcome, we sort of say that's random. So I had mentioned the coin flip. Coin flips You know, it's a roughly 50-50 on which way it'll land. But if somebody, you know, were maybe they had a slow motion camera or something and watched the actual flip and knew where it was, you know, at what elevation it was going to be caught and knew all the conditions, it would be possible, though it would be difficult, I'll acknowledge, it would be possible to actually predict that outcome. So that's not truly random. You know, we talked about the stars and where they are in the sky. You know, it's gravitation of the collapse of all of these, you know, cosmological gases that actually determined where those stars are in the sky. You know, there's all of these things that sort of determine the way that things are. And so this whole idea that everything isn't really random, it has a name. It's called determinism. And I, for one, am actually a big subscriber to determinism. I do think that nearly everything, with one caveat, is deterministic, is determined by cause and effect. Does that make sense? Am I kind of illustrating that?
Yeah, no, you're illustrating it very well. And I'm gonna back up just a bit.
Yeah, go for it.
In that, I subscribe to the same thing now, but I can remember talks not too terribly long ago where you introduced me to the idea of this determinism. And I was actually kind of opposed to it. Like, you know what? I don't understand how you can make this assertion that the world as we experience it is deterministic. Because, well, I'm having these thoughts right now. Look, I can lift my left arm. You didn't know I was going to do that. Look, I can lift my right arm. I can do this. I'm obviously making my own decisions that exist outside of cause and effect. And then the more I thought about it, I realized, well, no. The reason I raised my left arm is because you told me that the world was deterministic.
Right.
And that triggered an electrical response in the neurons in my brain that caused a signal to be sent to my muscles to raise my arm. Even at me trying to express my free will immediately, it was still being caused by a preceding cause, I guess. And it kind of leads us, I guess, into the next phase of this episode, which is, if you believe in the random, if you believe in a cause and effect physical universe, it doesn't jive well with free will. Everything that happens around us is a result of preceding effects, and you are a living cause of previous effects. Even if you wanted to go down the road, the reason you exist is because your parents on a certain night during your mother's ovulation cycle had sex and two cells bonded. And then the reason that happened is because both of their parents also had something similar, and you can go all the way back and through our lineage, even on an evolutionary scale, and show that you wouldn't be here if all of these preceding causes hadn't happened. It's inescapable. It's very much like a river that we're caught into. It's a current you can't escape. Maybe that's a good way of looking at it.
That's a really good metaphor, right? We're in the boat without a paddle, without an ability to affect the outcome.
Yeah.
And I think it is important to make a distinction. You know, this is kind of like one of those things where, you know, there's something to know, and then there's a way to sort of look at the world. So I can look at the world, and, you know, I look around my room here and I see, you know, I see that there's walls and they're made out of sheetrock with paint over them. And I have stuff hung up on the walls and all that. I can look at that and say, oh, there's my guitar over there. I, you know, it has some meaning to me. I like to play it. Or I can look at it and say, well, I'm looking around at everything and I see colors, and colors are actually an illusion. That everything seems so solid is an illusion because matter is mostly empty space and all of these things. you know, when I think it's important that when I assert that we don't really kind of have this free will, that I'm not saying people shouldn't be accountable for their actions. I'm not saying any of those things. Well, one can make the argument that I had no choice to say it, but there's a physical reality, and then there's, on top of that, there's another thing. There's the ethics of everything. So do I think that somebody who murders somebody shouldn't face any consequences because they had no choice? Absolutely not. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is I do think it's important to sort of realize this, and this ties in with our randomness thing, because I think the fact that we kind of see things as random leaves an opening for seeing agency in it. If we kind of swallow the jagged pill that the randomness isn't there, that there are causes for practically everything that we observe actually does have a cause, it kind of gives us a little bit of a inoculation against this ascribing agency to randomness, because randomness in nearly every endeavor does not exist. But where this ties in with like the free will thing is, I think these are important things to take into account. You know, if you have a person who's, you know, maybe had trauma in their life, or they've had all these things, that actually sort of helps you realize the importance of, you know, maybe how to help people who have had things happen to them. Maybe somebody has an inherited genetic thing. Maybe they're, you know, on a sociopathic scale. You know, that's not really something they have a choice about. We're basically these wet robots. We have some hardware in our skull, and our day-to-day lives will actually mold that hardware. But at the end of the day, we're getting an input, and then we make an output. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. Let's go back to the stream metaphor, the river metaphor, yeah. And we're on a boat without a paddle or a rudder. That river, that stream, that's causality. And that's what we're stuck in. And I don't want to say stuck, maybe held captive. Can you make a decision? Yes. Could you have made any other decision than the one you made? No. That's what
exactly.
I believe that's what we're asserting here. We're a product of so many preceding causes and the resultant effects that, in all honesty, we are held captive to this stream of causality. We've talked about the Big Bang before. I know at least you and I have, and I know it's obviously a subject a lot of people have talked about, but everything is coming from even the point pre-existing that, and we're in a rapidly expanding universe with atoms coming together and making matter and blah, 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 blah. We are a resultant of that. And to say anything else is just being in denial of what we see on a day-to-day basis. Even the way this conversation has gone, it was very much a cause and effect relationship. You would say something, you know, I mentioned the stars, and next thing comes up is
astrology.
I almost said cosmology. Good Lord. Astrology, which, you know, goes back to the constellations. Look at the patterns. That's stuff we didn't discuss before, but we're seeing the exact same thing we're talking about here actually happening. And it happens in our day-to-day life, but we have this knee-jerk reaction to reject it because we want to assign agency, even if it's only our own agency, to the events that happen in our lives. We cannot accept the fact that everything is just a Jenga tower that's falling down, and we really truly don't have any control over it. Now, the ugly side of this, and you've already kind of mentioned it, is the ethical side of it. And I think that's where a lot of people, if you can accept that, okay, I live in a cause and effect relation or a cause and effect relationship with the physical world, what about people that do evil? To that, I say, The punishment is the effect of the cause.
Right.
It doesn't say that you have a carte blanche, a blank check to do whatever the hell you want to in life, but the resulting discipline, whatever you want to call it, is a resultant effect to a cause. Now, whether or not you had a choice or not does not affect the outcome of it. This is a necessary, and I hate to use the word discipline because in maybe you can help me with this. We look at the punishment as a way of achieving justice, but justice also implies that there's some metaphorical cosmic scale.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say, a balance.
That sort of balance needs to be achieved, that there's some agency that's out there. When the truth of the matter, the cosmos doesn't give a shit about whether or not you cheated on your taxes and therefore need to go to jail. It really doesn't. There's no balance there. Now, is there a balance to society? Yeah, I can get that, but to me, and this is kind of a fledgling idea because I've struggled with this for a while and you've been involved with it a lot longer than I have, but looking at the punishment as a resulting effect is one thing, but maybe even that the punishment, let's say it's going to jail for murdering like you were talking about before, is a way of, I don't know, categorizing people that are more prone to have a negative effect on society, i.e. someone that's killed 30 people and putting them in jail. What are your thoughts around this?
So, I mean, I have some, maybe it's just an inescapable reality of society. The only thing I'm going to say about it is I have some problems with jail, and then I'm going to leave it at that. Mm-hmm. But if we were saying consequences, so there's a couple of things that are sort of important to, I think, enter into a conversation about the ethics of these consequences. So one is, the knowledge that if I do something, I will have a consequence is a deterrent to the action, right? So, maybe let's say I want to pick something that seems so realistic, like maybe everybody could relate with, even if they weren't going to, follow through with it. But, say you're at the gas station, and this will happen if you're, kind of on the interstates. You go to the gas station, there's like a bag of jerky, and it's like $20, like that kind of like, okay, I'm just going to pocket this. I'm just going to tuck it under my coat. And I'm just going to take it because $20 is just too much for this bag of jerky. But here's the deal. I know that what is the reward I get if I get away with it? The reward I get if I get away with it is I got this bag of jerky for free that maybe I felt was worth $5 and $20 was too much. So I had a $15 surplus of value in my eyes. But if I'm caught, now I have a criminal record. I have a reputation. I have some guilt and I have some shame. Even if it's just the guilt and the shame, or even if it's just the reputation without a criminal record, ask me, 6 months down the road, if I could undo all of that damage for that extra $15, would I do it? And I'd be like, well, hell yeah, this has been hell. So the knowledge of the consequence when you see it in others becomes an input, becomes part of the algorithm for everybody around who knows about it, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It very much becomes a part of that relationship. And in so much as you have the ability to make the decision, it weighs on that decision.
Yes, and you'd said something earlier that is so important, a thing to point out. And that was, you made the decision you made, it's just that you couldn't have made a different one. So I've had this discussion with people, and they're like, what, so we don't make decisions? I'm like, absolutely, you did make decisions. You have made every decision that you made in your life. The thing is, you couldn't have made a different one. And they're like, well, yeah, I could have. I could have picked, you know, turkey instead of ham. And I'm like, you can imagine yourself picking turkey instead of ham. But at the moment you picked turkey instead of ham, your brain made it weighed up whatever it is. It weighed up whatever you were craving. You know, your biology probably had something to do with that. Maybe you have fond memories of, you know, turkey sandwiches with grandma or whatever the case. But the moment you made the decision for turkey instead of ham, you could not have picked ham. Now, if I ask you 10 minutes later, when the variables are different, maybe you could have picked ham. And that's why the ethical thing, like you're saying, is important to bring up. Because if there's no chance of consequence, maybe I would go ahead and take the jerky. Right? I mean, there's these, it's important, I think, to make this distinction that consequences to those actions, they can be completely natural consequences. Say I didn't get thrown in jail for that. Well, I do still have some guilt. I do still have some shame, and I do have this reputation, right? I mean, if somebody steals from me and I know about it, it's going to take a lot for me to forgive them and for me to shut up about it to everybody we know. So there's some ostracizing going on. There's some shame going on. And those are just the natural consequences. That's without us actually using any force to punish. And like I said, I don't want to go too much. I'm not trying to go too much into that because I do have some ethical issues with the force in punishment. I don't think you would disagree with me on that, but.
No, not at all. But I mean, there's an interesting corollary there. Let's look at, is it Norway? I don't remember which one of the countries that did an experiment with their prison system, and they made it, instead of being punitive, they made it rehabilitational.
Yeah, and it was one of those countries. I don't remember. Yeah, but I know what you're talking about.
It's one of the Scandinavian ones, and they saw an immediate reduction in recidivism, which is the likelihood of a person returning to jail. And the consequences are definitely one thing, but also changing the resultant effects of the actual crime. Whereas you stole, let's say, that jerky. Here, maybe you go to jail, maybe you pay a fine, whatever else it is. If it's punitive enough, it will alter your course within the causality because you're now on a different, let's say, path of effects.
Yes.
If it were, as opposed to someone that was, let's say, in one of these countries where instead of receiving the punitive punishment, you actually sought rehabilitation and were put on a slightly different path where you would be less likely to be a repeat offender. Because let's say you didn't become a convicted felon or something else would prevent you from getting a job. So now you had to steal to feed your family, blah, 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 blah. All these resultant effects from this one causation. So there's a way, I think, in so much as we are trapped within causation, there are different paths within it, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you bring that up, you know, that's a really good point. You know, one time I was having this discussion and I said, okay, you know, say we have this thing that we have to be honest with ourselves about. Do we want to punish somebody for vengeance or do we want to actually help fix the person? Right. So the example I said is, okay, well, say you had, you know, you had a crack addict who'd been stealing a bunch of stuff, but because of some quirk in human biology, you know, if you gave them, you know, a candy bar, a Pepsi, and, you know, had them watch a Christmas movie, they'd be cured of their addiction. You know, would you rather throw them in jail, you know, punish them, punish them, punish them, punish them, or would you rather fix them if you had to pick one or the other? You know, and it's like, I'm not going to lie. I mean, as a human being, I do have this, you know, we were talking about that scale, you know, or that balance. You know, I do kind of have this urge to see everything put back in balance. You know, this person needs to be punished as bad as what they did to other people. You know, but then the real rational side of me is like, look, the world's better off if we're not, putting money into incarcerating this person. All of the appeals and the court process and all this stuff that's very expensive, let alone the fact that, you know, there might be people dependent on this person. You know, this person might not be a very productive member of society, but, you know, maybe they have a kid and, you know, that kid needs a parent. And if we could, you know, give them the candy bar, the Pepsi, and have them watch the Christmas movie, they go back and now they have a healed parent. You know, that's better for the kid. That's better for all of us. Everything's better. And it's hard to let go of that sort of bloodlust in us that wants, revenge, or, you know, what would a word be like a reparation for what was done to us or what was taken from us. But this is why I think this free will thing is important, to actually take into account, because sometimes counterintuitive things have impacts on the way that human beings are, but they might not satiate our need for quote unquote justice.
Right, and it's interesting sitting here and listening to it. And I can remember a time in a day where I'd be like, "Yeah, we got to send them to jail. We've got to make them pay for what they've done because they're no longer a productive member of society, or we've got to try to turn them into a productive member of society." And the reason I'm putting emphasis on it, and it didn't dawn on me until I heard it from you, but we really truly value a person's productive ability over the fact that they're a human being. Like you said, this could be a father, it could be a mother, it could be a brother, a son, who knows what them being out in society or actually putting them on a better path to better themselves and everyone around them would do. But we're so concerned about balance and productivity. It's like, we're not milk, or good Lord, we're not cows to be milked.
Right.
We shouldn't value ourselves based, or others, especially based solely upon production.
Right. Our output.
Output. Yeah. There's another good word for it. The ethic thing, I know a lot of people struggle with. I know there are times when I do, and it's tough. Like you said, we're wet robots, and all of this cosmic level justice, whether it be karma, whether it be final judgment, whether it be whatever, you know, it definitely, at least in my opinion, is still based on this primitive, I don't know, not societal bonding, but more of a social relationship with each other. And one could make the argument that it's based off of evolutionary pressures, selective pressures. Maybe it's because we've been surrounded by this artificial construct of agency to the randomness, and that if there's a reason why things happen, then maybe I can influence it. Maybe I can garner favor, or maybe they have an intent. And if I can just discern the intent of this agent, then things will work out better for me and my own. I don't know.
Yeah. And, I do agree with you. I human beings sit in a funny spot. Not among other creatures on Earth. I mean, there's a lot of them like us, but I mean, if we're thinking about just kind of the idea of how we exist, you have kind of your eusocial creatures. You have, you know, your ants and your bees, and things like that. That, I mean, they really kind of truly act as one super organism, you know. And then you have your your kind of lone animals that, you know, they really only get together with their own species to reproduce. And then you have, you know, humans. We're kind of in this middle ground between those two extremes, where we are definitely individuals. But we are social creatures as well. So my guess is that sort of these urges we have, the kind of that yearn for justice and that yearn for kind of punishment, my guess is that that's kind of the best thing, that it worked well enough to keep us cohesive and kind of in line with each other, as we were becoming Homo sapiens. But because it's kind of a biological drive, or an instinctual drive, maybe that's why we kind of let it get in the way of our reason. You know, a lot of instinctual things and biological things, you know, get in the way of our reason. And I'm perfectly okay with that. As long as, you know, people aren't using that to, you know, string up this person or that person because they think they're a witch, or to, you know, go conquer these other people because, you know, they see a different agent in the randomness than we do. So, you know, we need to get that land and we need to convert those people and all that, you know, kind of like we is a theme for us as people. I think, you and I and our ethics, it's, you know, live and let live. But these stamps of our lowly origin, as Charles Darwin put it, do have some dangerous consequences for how we interact with each other.
They do. If we could just figure out a way to remove a lot of these differences, and in my opinion, and we're kind of veering off, but I think it's a good place. If we could reject a lot of these divisive parts of our nature and just embrace the fact that we're all humans, and then look towards actually making it a better experience in so much that we can for our fellow humans and ourselves, I think things would be a lot better. We have this tendency of forgetting, you know, like a lot like the computer that I'm recording on right now, I'm looking at a Windows 10 interface, which let's say that's our reason, but behind all that facade is still binary and it's still taking place. And that's more of the primitive side. It's always going to be there, but we could do a much better job with the interface that overlays that base program. We're never going to get past our biology. We're never going to get past causality, but I think that we could do a better job with each other.
Yeah, that's a beautiful analogy. It really is. That's a good one. And to an extent, we do that, right? We root for a sports team rather than go to war. We do have these analogs for that. But that's a really good way of putting it.
If we could find an analog, and I know I pick on religion a lot, and I think a lot has to do because, you know, I'm still fairly newly atheist, but like my child not too long ago was watching a documentary on that. I can't remember the name of it. I know you know what it is. The one that refutes evolution. It's the experience or the arc experience, or God, I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Where sure. They're showing that humans and dinosaurs walk the planet at the exact same time. And it's in the Bible, and how upset and vitriolic people get when you reject their accepted form of reality, that their agent, the one that they have named or the one that they believe is tweaking the dials and twisting all this stuff to favor them for whatever reason, because it was meant to be. And you show them evidence that that does not actually exist. It's amazing the capacity for denial that we have.
You know, and the thing that's weird to me, is, you know, it's not all I'm doing as that person is saying, here's some information, here are some demonstrable facts. But the anger isn't, the anger is, at me, the deliverer, mm-hmm. you know, for delivering that information. And it's funny, you know, sometimes I'll roll my eyes and scratch my head and maybe sometimes laugh in jest. But, you know, I can't think of somebody saying, you know, oh, I do think there was a flood 6,000 years ago, and me getting really pissed off at them. Like it's definitely a strange thing. But, you know, kind of like we've touched on a lot is when you kind of have your identity tied up into these ideas, it becomes, I think, a part of you. And then an attack on that feels like an attack on the person.
Just like with the football team or the baseball team.
Right.
You associate with it so strongly. And one of the last ones that I'll leave you with, it's very funny. We were talking about free will. When I talk about that concept, the people I get the strongest rejection, that's the word I'm looking for, are Christians. At least, you know, I don't talk to many other denominations just because we live in the United States. Sure. And it's very prevalent. But the assertion that, yes, I have free will, God told me so.
Yeah.
I'm like, you do realize how stupid right. and asinine what you just
yes.
said.
Yes. Is. Yeah. Yeah. I'm free because God allows me to be.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And of course you bring that up and there's, you know, you could probably name all the objections, but I'm like, okay, are you free from sin? Well, no. Okay, you don't have free will. Why are you not free from sin? Well, because Adam transgressed in the Garden of Eden. Did you have any control over it? No, you right. did not. Do you have free will? Yes, I still have free will. Can you rejoin your Heavenly Father without being baptized? No, I cannot. Do you have free will?
Of course I
and
do.
It doesn't matter how yeah. far down the chain. Yeah, of course I do. Exactly. Exactly. And you go down the line, and I'm not just picking on those guys. I imagine you could do the same with many of the other religions that promise paradise if you only accomplish these certain things to tip the right. cosmic
it's,
balance.
It's what we in the know. Favor of, we're in the United States. We're in the Midwest. You know, so it's sort of, we're kind of eating our own kind here a little bit, but it's because it's what we encounter. You know, the things that affect you and I are not so much, you know, what do Muslims or Jews believe and how that affects our life and what gets legislated because of that. It tends to be Christians. So that's kind of what we're going to concentrate on.
Absolutely. Well, did you have anything in summation you wanted to throw out there before we end this one?
No, I really, well, one thing. Okay. So you had brought up, you know, kind of us seeing how we're all humans underneath this and kind of help understand that. And the best analog for that, or the best analogy, it's not even an analogy, it's true, that has sort of given me that feeling of you know, camaraderie with my fellow humans, is the fact that we find all these ways to divide ourselves and kind of see each other as enemies when we don't need to be. You know, it might be, you know, where we were born, what country we're in, what God we worship or don't worship, or whatever the case. But here's a thing that is true. That's kind of, it's an idea that can knock you on your butt. And that's, you know, human beings have been here 200,000 years. And, you know, God knows how many, well, I say God knows, nobody knows maybe how many billions of human beings have existed, you know, from this point to the beginning of what we would say are Homo sapiens. But right now, you know, we get this little window of, you know, probably 60, 70 years, average 70 years, we'll say, where we do get to live together in the same time. So we get this, we all have this little tiny sliver of existence in the history of humanity, and everybody around you is sharing that same sliver of existence. So if you think about how astronomical it is that your sliver and that guy next to you, that little sliver of time where you get to exist, overlaps, you actually have a ton in common, because you'd be a very different person. The world was very different 200 years ago, and it'll be very different 200 years in the future. But we actually share the same time in the development of humanity. And that's actually a really cool thing, because the development of humanity is something that's come a very long way, and it's happening very quickly. So to be able to kind of have that same window of time with another human being is a statistically small chance that you get to share this time with everybody who is alive right now.
That is very true. And I'll leave one last thought. It's kind of a funny one, but going back to the stream metaphor, the stream of causality, I don't know if you've ever been on a float trip, but eventually you need to take a piss. You need to use the restroom.
Right.
My cautionary tale would be this. Keep in mind that we're all in the same stream, and the shit you send out and the piss you send out in that stream travels with you, and you're going to be swimming in it yourself. So think about it before you start sending out really shitty stuff into the stream.
Nice. That's good.
Yeah, I like it. Well, with that, we're going to wrap up this episode. Thank you so much for hanging in there with us. We definitely appreciate it. And we'll see you next time on Descent into Descent.